Chapter 128. Attached in all his fortunes? Not much to boast of in that. What can a woman at my age do? My husband and I deceived one another when we married. We must bear the consequences of the deception, that is to say, bear one another, and bear the burden of scheming together for today's dinner, and tomorrow's breakfast till death divorces us. Apostrophe, with those words, she walks out into Duke Street, St. James. Mr. Twemlow, returning to his sofa, lays down his aching head on its slippery little horsehair bolster, with a strong internal conviction that a painful interview is not the kind of thing to be taken after the dinner pills which are so highly salutary in connection with the pleasures of the table. But 6 o'clock in the evening finds the worthy little gentleman getting better, and also getting himself into his obsolete little silk stockings and pumps, for the wandering dinner at the Veneerings. And 7 o'clock in the evening finds him trotting out into Duke Street, to trot to the corner, and save a sixpence in coach hire. Tippins the Divine has dined herself into such a condition by this time, that a morbid mind might desire her, for a blessed change, to sup at last, and turn into bed. Such a mind has Mr. Eugene Rayburn, whom Twemlow finds contemplating Tippins with the moodiest of visages, while that playful creature rallies him on being so long overdue at the Woolsack. Skittish as Tippins with Mortimer Lightwood too, and has raps to give him with her fan for having been best man at the nuptials of these deceiving, what's their names who have gone to pieces. Though, indeed, the fan is generally lively, and taps away at the men in all directions, with something of a grisly sound suggestive of the clattering of Lady Tippins' bones. A new race of intimate friends has sprung up at Veneering's, since he went into Parliament for the public good, to whom Mrs. Veneering is very attentive. These friends, like astronomical distances, are only to be spoken of in the very largest figures. Boots says that one of them is a contractor who, it has been calculated, gives employment, directly and indirectly, to 500,000 men. Brewer says that another of them is a chairman, in such request at so many boards, so far apart, that he never travels less by railway than 3,000 miles a week. Buffer says that another of them hadn't a sixpence 18 months ago, and, through the brilliant eye of his genius in getting those shares issued at 85, and buying them all up with no money and selling them at par for cash, has now £375,000. Buffer particularly insisting on the odd 75, and declining to take a farthing less. With Buffer, Boots, and Brewer, Lady Tippins is eminently facetious on the subject of these fathers of the Script Church. Surveying them through her eyeglass, and inquiring whether Boots and Brewer and Buffer think they will make her fortune, if she makes love to them? With other pleasantries of that nature. Veneering, in his different way, is much occupied with the fathers too, piously retiring with them into the conservatory, from which retreat the word committee is occasionally heard, and where the fathers instruct Veneering how he must leave the valley of the piano on his left, take the level of the mantelpiece, cross by an open cutting at the candelabra, seize the carrying traffic at the console, and cut up the opposition root and branch at the window curtains. Mr. and Mrs. Podsnap are of the company, and the fathers descry in Mrs. Podsnap a fine woman. She is consigned to a Father Boots father, who employs 500,000 men, and is brought to anchor on Veneering's left, thus affording opportunity to the sportive Tippins on his right, he, as usual, being mere vacant space, to entreat to be told something about those loves of navvies, and whether they really do live on raw beefsteaks, and drink porter out of their barrows. But, in spite of such little skirmishes, it is felt that this was to be a wandering dinner, and that the wandering must not be neglected. Accordingly, Brewer, as the man who has the greatest reputation to sustain, becomes the interpreter of the general instinct. I took, apostrophe says Brewer in a favorable pause, a cab this morning, and I rattled off to that sale. Apostrophe, Boots, devoured by envy, says, so did one. Apostrophe, Buffer says, so did I, but could find nobody to care whether he did or not. And what was it like? Apostrophe, apostrophe inquires Veneering. I assure you, apostrophe replies Brewer, looking about for anybody else to address his answer to, and giving the preference to Lightwood. I assure you, the things were going for a song. Handsome things enough, but fetching nothing. Apostrophe, so I heard this afternoon, apostrophe says Lightwood. Brewer begs to know now, would it be fair to ask a professional man, how on earth these people ever did come to such a total smash? Brewer's divisions being for emphasis. Lightwood replies that he was consulted certainly, but could give no opinion which would pay off the bill of sale, and therefore violates no confidence in supposing that it came of their living beyond their means. But how, apostrophe says Veneering, can people do that? Apostrophe, ha! That is felt on all hands to be a shot in the bullseye. How can people do that? The analytical chemist going round with champagne looks very much as if he could give them a pretty good idea how people did that, if he had a mind. How, apostrophe says Mrs. Veneering, laying down her fork to press her aquiline hands together at the tips of the fingers, and addressing the father who travels the 3,000 miles per week. How a mother can look at her baby and know that she lives beyond her husband's means, I cannot imagine. Apostrophe, Eugene suggests that Mrs. Lammel, not being a mother, had no baby to look at. True, apostrophe says Mrs. Veneering, but the principle is the same. Apostrophe, Boots is clear that the principle is the same. So is Buffer. It is the unfortunate destiny of Buffer to damage a cause by espousing it. The rest of the company have meekly yielded to the proposition that the principle is the same, until Buffer says it is, when instantly a general murmur arises that the principle is not the same. But I don't understand, apostrophe says the father of the £375,000, apostrophe if these people spoken of occupied the position of being in society they were in society? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Veneering is bound to confess that they dined here and were even married from here. Then I don't understand, apostrophe pursues the father, how even their living beyond their means could bring them to what has been termed a total smash. Because there is always such a thing as an adjustment of affairs in the case of people of any standing at all. Apostrophe, Eugene, who would seem to be in a gloomy state of suggestiveness, suggests, suppose you have no means and live beyond them? Apostrophe, apostrophe, this is too insolvent a state of things for the father to entertain. It is too insolvent a state of things for anyone with any self-respect to entertain, and is universally scouted. But, it is so amazing how any people can have come to a total smash, that everybody feels bound to account for it specially. One of the fathers says, gaming table. Apostrophe, another of the fathers says, speculated without knowing that speculation is a science. Apostrophe, Boots says horses. Apostrophe, Lady Tippin says to her fan, two establishments. Apostrophe, Mr. Podsnap, saying nothing, is referred to for his opinion, which he delivers as follows, much flushed and extremely angry. Don't ask me. I desire to take no part in the discussion of these people's affairs. I abhor the subject. It is an odious subject, an offensive subject, a subject that makes me sick, and I apostrophe, and with his favorite right arm flourish which sweeps away everything, and settles it forever, Mr. Podsnap sweeps these inconveniently unexplainable wretches who have lived beyond their means and gone to total smash, off the face of the universe. Eugene, leaning back in his chair, is observing Mr. Podsnap with an irreverent face, and may be about to offer a new suggestion, when the analytical is beheld in collision with the coachman manifesting a purpose of coming at the company with a silver salver, as though intent upon making a collection for his wife and family, the analytical cutting him off at the sideboard. The superior stateliness, if not the superior generalship, of the analytical prevails over a man who is as nothing off the box, and the coachman, yielding up his saver, retires defeated. Then, the analytical, perusing a scrap of paper lying on the saver, with the air of a literary censor, adjusts it, takes his time about going to the table with it, and presents it to Mr. Eugene Rayburn. Whereupon the pleasant tippin says aloud, "The Lord Chancellor has resigned." ... With distracting coolness and slowness, for he knows the curiosity of the charmer, to be always devouring, Eugene makes a pretense of getting out an eyeglass, polishing it, and reading the paper with difficulty, long after he has seen what is written on it. What is written on it in wet ink is, "Young Blight." ... ... Says Eugene over his shoulder, in confidence, with the analytical. "Waiting." ... Returns the analytical in responsive confidence. Eugene looks "excuse me" towards Mrs. Veneering, goes out, and finds young Blight, Mortimer's clerk, at the hall door. "You told me to bring him, sir, to wherever you was, if he come, while you was out, and I was in." ... Says that discreet young gentleman, standing on tiptoe to whisper, "And I've brought him." ... Sharp boy. "Where is he?" ... Asks Eugene. "He's in a cab, sir, at the door. I thought it best not to show him, you see, if it could be helped, for he's a shaking all over, like Blight's simile is perhaps inspired by the surrounding dishes of sweets like glue manche." ... Sharp boy again. ... Returns Eugene. "I'll go to him." ... Goes out straightway, and, leisurely leaning his arms on the open window of a cab in waiting, looks in at Mr. Dawes, who has brought his own atmosphere with him, and would seem from its odor to have brought it, for convenience of carriage, in a rum cask. "Now, Dawes, wake up." ... Mr. Rayburn? "Direction. 15 shillings. ... After carefully reading the dingy scrap of paper handed to him, and as carefully tucking it into his waistcoat pocket, Eugene tells out the money, beginning incautiously by telling the first shilling into Mr. Dahl's hand, which instantly jerks it out of window, and ending by telling the 15 shillings on the seat. "Give him a ride back to Charing Cross, sharp boy, and there get rid of him." ... Returning to the dining room, and pausing for an instant behind the screen at the door, Eugene overhears, above the hum and clatter, the fair tippin saying, "I am dying to ask him what he was called out for." ... "Are you?" ... mutters Eugene, "then perhaps if you can't ask him, you'll die. So I'll be a benefactor to society, and go. A stroll and a cigar, and I can think this over. Think this over." ... Thus, with a thoughtful face, he finds his hat and cloak, unseen of the analytical, and goes his way. Book the 4th, a turning. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.